the Supreme Court handed down its rulings on two cases related to same-sex marriage, as well as other issues such as affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate passed a bipartisan bill on immigration last night. Will it pass the House? Here in Wisconsin, we're awaiting the governor's signature on the state budget bill. Many items hang in the balance as Governor Walker decides what to keep and what to veto. There's plenty to talk about as we round up the top news on the Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, I'm joined by two guests to debate and discuss the week in politics. We want to hear from you. What do you think about the decisions handed down by the Supreme Court or the immigration bill? Do you have your eyes on the state budget? What are you hoping survives the strike of the governor's veto pen? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guest. Christine Bremer-Moogley is an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau, and she's one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Welcome, Christine.
Good morning.
And Kevin Hermaning, political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for being here. So let's start off by talking about immigration reform. The Senate yesterday passed a bill by a 68-32 vote that provides a pathway to citizenship for millions of immigrants while promising to secure the border. We'll hear from President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner in a moment, but what do you think of the legislation, Christine Bremer-Moogley?
Well, I think, it's about time that we got something done on immigration reform, and I'm so glad that, you know, we had some leadership from the Gang of Eight. I think it's great that it's gone through, and I think that it'll put some pressure on the House to follow through. I think that it's sad that our senator didn't vote for it, Ron Johnson. Tammy Baldwin did, and it seems like the House now, according to Boehner, wants to do its own bill, and they're not going to follow through on some of the things, and some of the Republicans are calling it an amnesty bill, but really, it's a good bill. I mean, it gives a path to citizenship. It puts forward tough border security, and there's money involved in that. I think there's 20,000 agents and 700 miles of fence, if you like fence. It helps with the guest worker program, and in Wisconsin, it really helps with our dairy farmers, and it does away with this old visa system we had. So I think that if you look at it as a whole, it's moving forward. It's very significant legislation. I think it's a centerpiece of what the Obama administration will accomplish if it goes through. So I know there'll be a lot of fireworks in the House, but I'm really happy the Senate moved ahead.
What about you, Kevin Hermaning? What did you think of the bill?
Well, I think it is definitely not the direction that the country seemingly wants to go. Neither of them want to take us down this path. Christine did talk about the whole issue of border security being enhanced, but really it puts way too much power in the hands of an appointed official to essentially decide on her own, in this case, Janet Napolitano, whether she wants to actually enforce the border security rules, the laws, to actually build the fence. We've already had legislation for, I believe, about 5 or 6 years that was supposed to build, I believe, 700 miles of fence. And I think we have about 21 miles built so far because the Department of Homeland Security has already punted on their responsibilities in this area. And so, you know, there are people who think that we need to be passing these kinds of laws where we give people who have come to our country illegally rights to full benefits as American citizens, that they shouldn't have to wait in line. They should have to wait in line. They should have to return to their countries if they then want to follow the rules to come into the United States in a true immigration process and then become citizens using the regular rules. I have a very good friend who just became a citizen about 3 weeks ago. He's been in this country legally, having been born in California. He's been in this country legally for over 50 years, and he decided a couple of weeks ago that he wanted to become a United States citizen and did that. He followed the rules. He's in the system. He's in the process of being a full citizen and has been paying into Social Security and has been paying his income taxes. And we've got too many people who are under the radar. And this bill is not going to do anything to get people to come out of the shadows, because there is very little responsibility that is being put on the folks who are going to basically get a free pass in this area. I don't think that the House is going to be able to come up with a bill that the Senate can swallow. I think this was a pure political stage effort, and I think that we're going to not see a conference that is going to bring a bill to the president which he can sign.
Well, I just have two things. Kevin, I think that it's amazing that you talk about the path to citizenship as you do. I really think that's a regressive approach. Even Paul Ryan agrees that this bill does something for the first time to allow those people who are unauthorized in this country to do the right thing, to pay their taxes and to get it right. And it gives them a chance to get it right. Just saying that they should, you know, self-deport certainly isn't something that the people of this country supported, in, as is seen in the last election. And so I think that looking forward and solving the problem and saying let's try to find a way to allow these people who have been in our country working and providing, you know, some real good, meaningful assistance to our job market and jobs that people don't want to do often. You know, it's a good thing. And even if Paul Ryan can agree with that, I'm surprised you don't. And with regard to the fence and the border, I don't know if you're criticizing Janet Napolitano, but she's been one of the most tough Homeland Security secretaries we've had. And our borders have been more secure under this administration than they have under any other administration. So, you know, personally, I think the fence is not a good idea. I don't think fences are a good way to keep people out. But, you know, if it takes building a fence to get the Republicans to vote to do something really good for our country, then I guess I'm in favor of it, too.
Basically, you're saying, Christine, that 11 million people should be cutting in line in front of the people who are following the rules. I patently disagree with that philosophy and that principle and that idea. And I, for the life of me, do not believe that Paul Ryan believes that 11 million people should cut in line because they've broken the law.
Well, President Obama said earlier this week to a group of business people that the bill is not exactly what he wanted, but that he can live with it.
It's not a bill that represents everything that I would like to see. It represents a compromise. And I think all the business leaders here recognize that there are elements of it that they might want to tweak one way or another. But it does adhere to the core principles that we need for a comprehensive immigration reform. And now is the time to do it.
Christine Bremer-Moogley, what do you think, if anything, could make the bill better in your mind?
Well, I think that if we're going to try to make the bill better, we have to, first of all, we have to find a way we can get it passed. That's the most important thing. I think that the bill that the Senate has come up with the Gang of Eight is reflects a very strong compromise. Adding in the $40 billion for protections and border security, I think is enough to make it something that is palatable. I do not believe this is an amnesty bill. No one is cutting in line, as Kevin said. I think that's a cute term, but it doesn't have any meaning. And what we're talking about is what people should do, which is pay their taxes, set it right with the government, and then become citizens. My husband is not a citizen of this country, and he intends to make application just as you said, Kevin, and he's been paying his taxes and doing the right things. But, you know, I think that other people should be given the chance if they've come in under certain circumstances that maybe they didn't even control, but they should be given the chance to set it right. And that's what this bill does, and that's why it's gotten support, even of Senator Rubio, who is certainly someone who is not in favor of amnesty. So I think the stronger minds will come together, and the people that know what the meaning of true compromise is will compromise and will make something good happen for the people of our country.
And here's House Speaker John Boehner saying Republicans in the House are not going to simply rubber stamp the bill that passed the Senate yesterday.
The House is not going to take up and vote on whatever the Senate passes. We're going to do our own bill through regular order, and it'll be legislation that reflects the will of our majority and the will of the American people.
Kevin, what are you expecting to come from the House? And do you think something will ultimately pass Congress and become law?
Well, I think probably the member of Congress who is closest to where I believe the majority of the American people are on this issue. And Christine apparently disagrees with this position, but I don't think very many people support a pathway to, quote, citizenship for people who are here who've broken the law. There's a congressman from Arizona. His name is Matt Salmon, Salmon like the fish. I think that when he talks about supporting legislation in the House that would develop a secure border to keep people out of our country, like almost every other country in the world does, including Mexico, by the way. They have very strong anti-illegal immigration rules in their country, very strong. And you don't want to end up in a Mexican prison, which people do if they break the laws, like Mexicans and other people from around the cities, around the country who come to our country illegally. They don't end up in prison, in the Mexican-type prisons in the United States. There are a lot of people who believe that we need a mechanism for allowing these folks to work in the United States legally. And I think everything that should be done should be based on good, sound policy and what's right for this country. It's about time that Republicans in Washington stand up and act like statesmen rather than pander to various groups. People who act as statesmen end up getting respect from people across both aisles of the political fence. And fences are a way to keep people out. They're also a way to keep people in. In this case, they'd be a way to keep people out of the country or to keep people in their own countries. And so we already have a policy in the United States which allows for legal immigration, and those rules are the ones that ought to be enhanced and improved upon, because we do need workers from other countries to do low-skill jobs as well as high-skill tech jobs and medical-related jobs and research jobs. But it's not going to be accomplished with this kind of a bill.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can give us a call with your thoughts on the top headlines. We're talking about immigration right now. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'll also be moving on soon to the Supreme Court cases that have been decided this week and also our state budget, plus much more. Our guests today are Christine Bremer-Moogley, attorney with Bremer and Trollop Law Offices in Wausau, and she's one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Kevin Hermaning is a political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Week in Review. This week's guests are Christine Bremer-Moogley, attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau, and she's one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Kevin Hermaning from Stevens Point. He's a political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. We've been talking about immigration. Let's take a call on that from Bill in Lancaster. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I don't think more Border Patrol agents is going to help. I don't think a better fence is going to help. I don't think a pathway to citizenship is going to help. Illegal immigrants are victims in their own country. That's why they come to this country. And when they get to this country, they continue to be victimized. And the real criminals, I feel, in this country are the people who employ them, knowingly employ them. And I think that those people need to be fined heavily, their companies need to be fined heavily, and they need to be put in jail. They're simply just further victimizing illegal immigrants. They're here because they were victimized in the first place.
What do you think about that, Christine?
Well, I think the bill does provide for some sanctions for employers that have really not been enforced at all. And I think Bill makes a good point that these people have been victimized, and they are re-victimized when they come to this country and are treated the way they are, and yet come in and because of the lure of jobs that they can't get in their own country. So, I think that this bill has to cover so many fronts. There are so many things that have to be looked at, and that's just one of them. You know, so I think that when we look at legislation that is so encompassing, we have to do what is right for most Americans, and what would be right for the people that are here is to enter into a legislation that is a compromise, that does not provide amnesty, but instead a path for people to go forward. And even as I've said, leading Republicans don't believe this is an amnesty bill, that provides caps for people to come in, but allows highly skilled workers to come in, that does provide some border security to satisfy some of the requirements of some of the conservatives that are against it. But I think it also has to protect these immigrants, and they have to look at the responsibilities of employers who are providing jobs to them and not doing the right thing and paying them cash under the table. So I agree with Bill. This bill has to take that into consideration, and it does.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, Christine keeps saying that this is not an amnesty bill, but this is extremely similar. The Senate bill is extremely similar to what happened back in the 1980s, where it granted legal standing and citizenship beyond just legal standing to be here, to work here, to participate in society here. It actually gave citizenship to people who came into the country illegally. We're not talking in this case about political sanctions against people in foreign countries, and that's why they've come here seeking political amnesty. We're talking about people who've broken the law to come here to take advantage largely of our social safety net. That is almost exclusively what this is about. It's not about people who are coming here to contribute to society, to be full, gainfully employed, taxpaying citizens, to be givers as well as takers. We're talking almost exclusively about the 11.5 million illegal immigrants who are already breaking the law, A, because they came into the country, B, because they're working for employers who themselves are breaking the rules and breaking the laws, and not enough sanctions have been put against them. And it doesn't matter to me whether they are a small independent farmer or whether they're a big major corporation. If you are employing an illegal immigrant, an illegal alien, that's what they are. That's the way it's defined in the law. They shouldn't be allowed to work here until they are granted legal status. And there are four million people right now in line in their own countries waiting to come to the United States legally. And you have just given these people a waiting list because it's going to be years before they can legally immigrate to the United States because of how the U.S. is potentially going to bring these 11.5 million people online. Frankly, I don't think that the House is going to pass a bill, as I said earlier, that the president can sign.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what about Bill in Lancaster's point, though, that so you kind of addressed his first point, which is he says that illegal immigrants are victims in their own country and now they're becoming victims here. But the other thing that he kind of slipped in there was, why not fine the employers who are hiring these immigrants? What do you say to that?
Employers are getting fined when they're caught employing illegal aliens. They are already fined. They're already then sanctioned. It's already against the law to employ somebody in these positions. One of the problems is the government isn't really sanctioning them to the degree that they should, so that they stop doing it. Businesses typically pass on costs to consumers across the board, whether it's tax costs, regulatory costs, the cost of salaries and benefits, all those things for their employees, and tax-related and regulatory-related rules are passed on to consumers. And so businesses build this as part of their cost of doing business. That's a problem. They need to be able to, the government needs to step in and position themselves as the arbiter, the rule, the people who are going to enforce the rules. And we have way too lax of the system in this area.
Okay, Kevin, I don't know if you walked into a doorway or something, but your cell phone connection just kind of got a little bit garbly. So if you could undo whatever you just did to make that happen, we'll hear you a lot more clearly. In other news, it was a big week for the U.S. Supreme Court, handing down opinions on gay marriage, voting rights, and affirmative action. So let's start with the Defense of Marriage Act. In a 5-4 ruling, the court struck down a provision of DOMA that denied federal benefits to gay married couples. The court also left in place a finding by a trial court that California's Proposition 8, which bans same-sex marriage, is unconstitutional. Kevin, did the Supreme Court get gay marriage right or wrong?
Well, I would say, first of all, that this is there's been a lot of mischaracterization of what the Supreme Court actually did. I think that they have way overstepped their bounds. They have disrespected what I consider the rights of Congress in the United States. But, you know, the number of states whose marriage laws remain the same after this week's court decisions is still 50. Really, there was no change to marriage laws in any state in the union as a result of these rulings earlier this week. There are still 38 states that define marriage as the union of a man and a woman, which I think is biblically based. That includes, by the way, California, where beyond the scope of the Proposition 8 decision, which was actually what brought these to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court punted it back to the state appellate court and said, listen, this is beyond our purview. We're not going to act in this regard. And so there's going to be ongoing debate and, of course, further litigation. And but what it did do is there are 12 states, the ones that do not recognize marriage only as the union of a man and a woman. They can now force the federal government to recognize their redefinition of marriage because the court struck down only one section, by the way, of DOMA. Just one section. Section 3 was the one that was struck down. And now that's significant. I don't in any way want to suggest that it's not very, very important. I think it was a bad decision. I don't think it was correct at all. And what's interesting is that, and I think this is being lost on a lot of people, which is perhaps good because so many of these things have been clouded by misrepresentation of what really happened. Wisconsin is not going to have to recognize, of course, any other state's redefinition of marriage. Wisconsin's law we are not going to be forced to recognize by somebody who lives in a different state, which allows for marriage between men and men and women, where it's recognized in their home state. We don't have that recognition in our state, and the Supreme Court decision did nothing to force us to do that. So it's going to continue to be regulated at the state level. Bottom line, I think that the court got federalism wrong.
Okay. Christine Reamer-Moogly, what is your reaction to the Supreme Court's decision?
I'll be interested in hearing if Kevin thinks the court got federalism wrong with regard to the Voting Rights Act. But let's talk about this. What we're talking about here is how the Defense of Marriage Act applied to federal benefits that are available to gay and lesbian couples married in states. And that is what it was. That was the issue before the court. And it was decided on the basis of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which provides that all people have the right to equal protection of the law. And so when we talk about this law, what Justice Kennedy said was, this section of the law does not put forward any legitimate purpose of the government. And in very strong language for Justice Kennedy, he said it demeans the moral and sexual choices of people and humiliates children who are in those marriages. So children who are being raised by gay and lesbian couples were being demoralized and humiliated, according to Justice Kennedy. And I think he felt very strongly about that. It was evident in the oral argument that that was going to be a very important point for him as he reviewed this law. And he applied, and the majority applied a standard to the law, which was a standard that was called careful consideration, really, of what the law's impacts would be. And so the court said, look, this is not right to say that this couple, and it was based on an older couple from New York. Her name was Edna Spire and her partner. And they had been married in 2007. And after their marriage, the one died. And she left behind, all of her things to her married partner, Edna. And Edna was then forced to pay $300,000 in estate taxes. And that's why this case came forward, because when she went to her lawyer, the lawyer said, well, if you had been married to a man, you wouldn't have had to pay those taxes. And so the case came forward on that very simple issue. It's not fair to make two people who are married legally to have to pay more tax simply because of who you love or who you're married to. And so it was on that basis that this decision came forward, and it was the right decision. And it was a decision that was looking solely, and it was narrow, and it was solely looking at this issue, what federal benefits can be denied to a couple who are legally married. And so in any state where couples are legally married, they cannot be denied federal benefits. And I believe Kevin is right when he says there will be more litigation, because this will apply, you know, possibly to any couple that's legally married in this country who wants legal benefits with regard to the tax code or over 1,000 federal laws that apply to marriage rights. So, and it should. And so we will see more litigation over this, more likely than not, where people are denied their right when they are legally married to have the benefit of our federal laws. So I think it was the right decision. It was a heartfelt decision by Justice Kennedy. I think that, you know, it's sad that we had such scathing dissent from Scalia, but I guess that's what he likes to do in terms of stating, you know, when he's wronged. He likes to say what he's wronged about. And you know, he really, Scalia really did foresee this when a decision came down earlier, when he said that this decision will lead to legalization of gay marriage. It's not going to legalize gay marriage. Kevin's right. In Wisconsin, we have a constitutional amendment. But the question is, how long will that stay? How long the Constitution reflects, you know, the society? And 2 years ago, we passed that amendment, or in 2006, we passed that amendment. And will it stay? I don't know. But we do know that there will be more litigation if legally married people are denied equal access and equal protection of the laws and denied federal benefits.
That's Christine Bremer-Moogly, attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau, and she's one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. And Kevin Hermaning is our other guest, political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster, sitting in for Joy Cardine. In another case, the federal government declared unconstitutional a provision of the Voting Rights Act, the provision that determines which states and localities have to get Washington's thumbs up to make changes to election laws. The Supreme Court said the law relies on old data that doesn't reflect racial progress and changes in society today. Christine, what do you make of that ruling?
Well, I think this ruling was really a tragedy for our country, because I think it's very clear that the Voting Rights Act is a very, very important cornerstone of our civil rights movement and the legislation that was put in place to make certain that people are protected in their vote. You know, right now, this is what the court decided, that basically Justice Roberts said that this law, the Voting Rights Act, which was first put in place in 1960s and then reauthorized by Congress, and it started in 1965 and then reauthorized by Congress at least twice, and then the last time in 2006 with a vote by Congress, if we can even imagine this kind of a margin, 98-0 in the Senate and 390-33 in the House, huge margins. And this vote was taken after, despite what the court, what Justice Roberts said, it was taken after there was a great deal of investigation and a great deal of deliberation and over 15,000 documents reviewed by the Congress to make a decision that it was still necessary to have voting protections or preclearance for certain states that had and jurisdictions that had a history of discrimination and prohibiting people from voting or causing people to be discriminated against in their right to vote. And so in those jurisdictions, when they wanted to reenact a law that had not been in place after the Voting Rights Act, or if they wanted to enact a new law, they had to get clearance from the Department of Justice in order to do so, just to make certain that there was not going to be discrimination against the people that wanted to vote, especially African Americans. And so in the case of the last few years, if we look at what the history has been with regard to the Department of Justice and preclearance, the Brennan Administration for Justice has found, and they did a study on this recently, they found that 31 laws were blocked by the Department of Justice between 2006 and the present, and 153 blocked between 1995 and 2005. And they were blocked because it was found that those laws would not, wouldn't somehow harm people's right to vote. So, you know, the court decided in this decision that because, Justice Roberts said, because the Congress had not put in new findings and based their decision to reauthorize in 40-year-old statistics, that this standard would not be upheld. And the court said, Congress has to go back and make new findings to determine if they are going to allow preclearance and treat different states differently with regard to their right to pass voting legislation. And we know in Wisconsin that voter ID has been something that we have all looked at very closely, and it's in litigation right now in our state, and it is in other states. And as soon as the court passed this law, we know voter ID laws are going to go in effect in Texas and a lot of the states that are subject to the Voting Rights Act. So that's a long answer, but my answer is that I think this is a tragedy, and I hope that Congress acts immediately. And I know that there are many in Congress that are looking to act quickly to make certain that the Voting Rights Act can be reauthorized with very robust standards with regard to protection of people's rights to vote.
Kevin Hermaning, what were your thoughts on that ruling?
Well, obviously, it was a 5-4 ruling that has already created a lot of consternation amongst the liberals, who are completely, as always, misrepresenting what the objections of the court really were to just one section, Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. What a lot of people fail to recognize is that in states which have a preponderance, a very high percentage of African-American voters, such as Mississippi and Georgia, that those states already have some of the highest turnout rates during elections, exceeding that even of white voters. And the court did, you're right, the court, the majority said that our country has changed, that the entire Voting Rights Act has not been overturned. Christine mentioned earlier, she wanted to know how I felt about federalism. In fact, this is a huge victory for federalism, and it's a sign, I think, of the tremendous racial progress that our country's made since the time that the Voting Rights Act, by those very wide margins back, 50 years ago, that it was passed. So the Supreme Court steps forward. They invalidate just one section of the Voting Rights Act, and that's the one that provided for the coverage formula for requiring certain jurisdictions. Literally just 9 states and some counties and 6 others to seek clearance in advance by the Justice Department or a federal court in D.C. before they made changes to voting laws. So those were, I think, extraordinary intrusions into state sovereignty and the real principles of federalism. So I think what we're going to see is, you're right, Christine, we're going to see states step forward and say, all right, we now know that we have the ability and right to put in place everything from motor voter rules, if that's what we want to do, because states typically set their own rules for elections. I think that's a good thing. But the states are not going to be allowed to discriminate against classes of people. The states, like Wisconsin, are likely to pass voter laws that allow for IDs, and heaven forbid we would use an identification card to go out and vote on election day, because we might want to do it just like we do when we try to get on an airplane. And Christine, you and I both travel, and we have to show an ID. Yes, if people get on an airplane and they aren't the right person, they could cause havoc, just like people can cause havoc in the election process if they try to vote 2 or 3 or 4 times, or for that matter, vote as somebody else who's not entitled to vote in a particular jurisdiction.
Okay.
The court got it right here.
All righty. Let's try to get a caller in on this issue before we move on. Will in DeForest, you're on the air.
Yes, I think that voter rights was a tragedy that the Supreme Court did. And I think if Kevin walked in the shoes of one that had ancestors who have been blocked from voting, he'd understand where I'm coming from. When you got legislation that's passed down by an organization called ALEX that went nationwide for voter ID and all other means of suppressing votes, and the Supreme Court take out a major part of what protect voters' rights, this is going back into the 1850s.
I think that Will is absolutely right. If we just look at an example in Florida, which is one of the states subject to pre-clearance of their voting laws, in Florida, when they take away early voting, which disproportionately affects African Americans because they don't have time to vote on election day because of jobs and other problems that they have getting to the polls based on statistical analysis, We have people standing in line for 8 hours a week, which absolutely is a crime, in my opinion. And those kinds of laws that prevent, you know, more hours for voting or early voting are laws that are exactly subject to Department of Justice review. If we look in Wisconsin, we can say this never happens, but just look at the bill that was put forward by the Republican GOP House member in Wisconsin, who wanted to put a bill in Wisconsin that said that if you don't have an ID because you can't afford one, then you can just say to the person at the table when you come in to check in to vote, I'm too poor to have a voting ID. And you have to state that, and you have to sign a document according to this bill that was just put forward that we'll see again. And you have to allow people standing within 5 feet to hear you say it. And then your ballot would be put to the side and then counted as a provisional ballot later. So, you know, these laws are not, this isn't something that's pie in the sky. It's right here in Wisconsin we have these kinds of things. And in states that have a history, like what Will said, when you have parents or ancestors that were prohibited from voting in certain states, and in states that had a history of discriminating, those states had to have preclearance. And that was a good law. And the fact that there are 76% of the blacks registered in those states is a reflection of the success of the Voting Rights Act. It doesn't mean we don't need it anymore. It means we need it more than ever.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, Will talked about the return to the 1850s. It is so hilarious to me to hear people talk about how these Supreme Court decisions are going to lead to these horrendous experiences for people, as though we're going to go back to slavery of African Americans before the Voting Rights Act, which occurred 110 years after the 1850s, and we're going to have slavery run rampant across the south of the United States like it was in the 1850s. It is ludicrous. It is demeaning to the average person listening, and Will knows better, and Will and I have crossed swords on multiple issues over the last 20 years. The reality I really truly believe is that Christine is throwing out red herrings such as this discussion about needing to portray oneself as poor before they can be allowed to vote, and then their ballot is set aside. Christine knows, as well as every listener, that when the voter ID rule was passed a couple of years ago in Wisconsin, signed into law by Governor Walker, that anybody who could not afford an ID was allowed to get one at no cost. And there was a woman from Merrill who was made a national example of somebody who was saying her rights were going to be disenfranchised. And it was so far from the truth, because the rules and the laws allowed somebody who did not have an ID, regardless of age, regardless of their financial condition, to simply say that they couldn't get an ID, they couldn't afford it, and they would be given one by the state at no cost to them. The taxpayers were going to afford it. It's interesting. You have to prove who you are with an ID to get public assistance in the state of Wisconsin. And so the idea that there are all these people out there without identification cards, this is really to allow people to run around and be able to vote to affect elections in areas where they do not geographically reside. And that's a big problem in our country, that people want to pursue rule changes that would allow that kind of behavior.
That's Kevin Hermaning. He's political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. Our other guest is Christine Bremer-Moogley, attorney with Bremer and Trollop Law Offices in Wausau. She's one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. This is the Week in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. Before we go to a break, let's take a moment to hold the Week in Review quiz. Here's your question, and you'll want to call in your guesses to 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email your answer to talk@WPR.org. So here's the question. This week, Forbes came out with its annual list of most powerful celebrities. Who came out on top this year? Once again, the question. This week, Forbes came out with its annual list of most powerful celebrities. Who came out on top? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, if you'd like to guess, and talk@WPR.org is our email address. This is the Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Friday at 11, it's Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. This is a busy time for gardeners. And Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab and UW Extension Horticulture Educator Lisa Johnson are here to help. They have lots of great advice to share Friday at 11 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned next hour. David Rhodes, an Iowa Writers Workshop alum who now lives in rural Wisconsin, joins Anne Strainchamps on 45 North. Rhodes just published the follow-up to his best-selling novel, Driftless, with a book that takes readers back to that community and introduces characters who struggle to find a new sense of belonging. That's next hour on 45 North. Right now, our guests are Christine Bremer-Moogley, attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau, and she's one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Kevin Hermaning is a political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party, and this is the Week in Review. Governor Walker signing the budget this Sunday, and he's getting hammered left and right with requests to veto or protect parts of the budget bill. Those include designating the Kringle as the official state pastry, vetoing bounty hunters, and a ban on banning junk food. If you can follow that, we're running a little short on time. So, Kevin and Christine, please be brief. Kevin, what would you advise Governor Walker to keep or kill from the budget?
I would advise the governor to focus on job creation and regulatory reform, meaning reducing the number of regulations on small businesses, which are the engine of job growth in the state of Wisconsin and across the country. All of these other petty, ridiculous things obviously are of great interest to people who live in certain geographic parts of the state. They are pet projects and pet ideas of certain legislators who apparently are either pandering or small-minded, and it's probably a little bit of both. And they really need to concentrate on working on the things that the state of Wisconsin residents are most interested in, which is making sure our kids can read, be competitive when they graduate from high school, get a job, and that our state's unemployed get back out into the workforce.
Christine Bremer-Moogley, what would you like to see in and out of the budget?
Well, there's four things. The first thing is, for me, I think school funding and the voucher program, allowing private citizens to, or private schools to take state money to fund schools, that should not be in our budget, and that should, we should have a statewide debate on that, and that should come out. Second thing, I think we do not need tax cuts. We need to refund education and make certain that the programs in our state that are very much suffering should be refunded, and our infrastructure should be rebuilt, so we don't need tax cuts that are essentially meaningless and really only benefit people that are of the income, like Kevin, for instance. And I think that with regard, the third thing would be health care. I think the governor should accept BadgerCare money, should accept Medicaid money, and that 90,000 people should not be taken off the roles of BadgerCare Plus and put into exchanges. They will not be receiving any health benefits, and we'll wind up having people in our emergency rooms like we did in the past, and that will not move us forward. And the fourth thing is, as a lawyer, I would think that this issue of bail bondsmen should absolutely not be in the budget. It came in the middle of the night or early morning before anyone knew anything about it, with no pre-notice. There is no one in the court system that supports going back to bounty hunters for our criminal bonds. And we have a great system in Wisconsin that is leading the nation, and we should not have that in the budget. So he should definitely veto that.
Well, I should mention that Joy Cardine will make her triumphant return with 2 hours on the state budget, with budget coverage starting Monday after 6. She'll talk with political scientist Charles Franklin, I believe, about the budget at 6 o'clock. And after 7 in the State Capitol Report, WPR's state government reporter Sean Johnson has more with the budget and other recent happenings in Wisconsin politics. Then we're hoping to talk to Governor Walker himself at 7:30. And we do have booked and confirmed Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca in the 7:30 half. That's all next Monday on the State Capitol Report. Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with a report yesterday showing that Wisconsin has added more than 62,000 private sector jobs in the first 2 years of Governor Walker's term. That ranks us 37th for job creation in the country. Christine, what does this report say about Walker's policies?
Well, I think it says it's certainly good to have an uptick with regard to this. We're doing very poorly, but we're still not doing well. I mean, this is still not a good news for our state. It's just a little bit better bad news. You know, right now he's still, we have 62,000 jobs in 2 years and went on a promise of 250,000. And I guess he's going to continue to use the recall as an excuse, which is pretty pathetic in my opinion. We shouldn't be, as Peter Barca, I think, said, we're not talking about bringing up the rear, but leading. If we look at the states that are our surrounding neighbors, they're doing so much better than we are. And these are states such as Minnesota that support programs for strong schools. They accepted the Medicaid dollars, and they've accepted transportation funding from the federal government. And in Minnesota, for instance, they are ranked way higher than Wisconsin. Their average capital income is 5 times greater than Wisconsin in terms of their populace. And so right now in Wisconsin, because of Walker's programs, the poor are being victimized and identified as the ones that are responsible for some of the problems that we have in our state, which is not right. And I think that, I hope that we can continue to do better. We all do. But we aren't doing better under these programs, and under Walker's policies, we've suffered. And we don't need an extreme social agenda. What we need is forward-looking and to help all the people of Wisconsin and our environment and our schools. And we certainly don't have that leadership now.
And Kevin Hermaning, you mentioned that job creation is important to you. How do you feel about these statistics?
Well, it shows that the governor is going to have a real task ahead of himself as he enters into the election cycle, which is going to already begin in earnest this November. We'll only be 1 year out from the reelection effort, and the governor is certainly going to have to answer to his claim that he would work to create 250,000 new jobs during his first 4 years in office. Christine is right. He is going to talk about, and his supporters are going to talk about how the recall election, all of those difficult months have gotten in the way of some of that focus. I think there is some validity to that, maybe a lot of validity to it, but the reality is that it's still an election claim that was made, and he's going to have to stand up and answer as to why it didn't happen, if in fact it doesn't occur over the course of the next 17 months or so. I think there are some opportunities for the state to increase the jobs that he is seeking, that all of us are seeking, on the left and the right. Christine, I know, is very much interested in seeing the job picture improve in the state of Wisconsin. We just have a philosophically different way in which we approach this. I think less litigation and less regulatory burdens on government, for that matter, also on government entities across the state, townships and cities and villages, but also on small businesses. I think that when we look at the tax climate, Wisconsin's tax climate is not very good, comparatively speaking. We have a very, very high income tax rate. I don't think that the budget that was passed, including tax policy, was very bold. I think we have some pretty timid leaders in the House and the Senate, the Assembly and the Senate in Madison, who are unwilling to step up and make an example of how Wisconsin can be a tax leader for residents and small business owners in the state of Wisconsin, something that would attract businesses seeking a different environment in which to operate than California and other high tax states around the country, people who might be interested in relocating their facilities here. Governor Perry has a lot going for him down in Texas, including a great climate and a utility scenario down there. Wisconsin doesn't have the same climate as Texas. In some cases, thankfully, it's so ridiculously hot and humid along the Gulf area. But we could replicate some of that from a tax policy, and I think that our leaders have been a little timid in that area and could certainly step up and make it better.
Okay, Kevin. Well, it's time to reveal the answer to our Week in Review quiz. We want to congratulate Paul in Rhinelander. He's our winner. The question was that Forbes just named its most powerful celebrity of 2013. The answer was Oprah Winfrey. Well, Kevin and Christine, thank you so much for being with us today in the Week in Review.
Thank you.
Christine Bremer-Moogley is attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau and one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Kevin Hermaning is political activist and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. They joined us today for the Week in Review. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this hour, Christy Taylor for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine, who will be back on Monday. This is the Ideas Network.